I guarantee you that Reason published on a campus would be defunded, and that you'd be up on harassment charges every other week.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV, and today we're talking with Alan Charles Kors, who is the Henry Charles Lee Professor of History at University of Pennsylvania, the co-founder of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and one of the great historians of the Enlightenment, in fact, the editor of the Oxford Encyclopedia of the Enlightenment. Alan, thanks for talking with us.
My privilege.
Let's talk about higher education, free speech, related issues. Let's start with the higher education bubble. People like Glenn Reynolds, a law professor who runs instapundit.com, has written a book about the higher education bubble. Other observers look at this. There has been a pronounced increase in the costs of college, the need or perceived need for a college education, for a diploma. Is there a higher education bubble? And if so, what do you think its causes and its outcomes are going to be?
When you get a subsidized tuition, universities will raise it. And in terms of all the debate about costs, there's no competition and there's subsidy, and a child could figure out what's likely to happen.
You've been at Penn since 68. In 1968, most jobs, even things like being a journalist, say, would not require a college degree necessarily. So what happened that we have to go to college now?
It seems to me as society and the economy became more complex in the skills it demanded, universities were in a unique position. They're the only institution in society allowed to sort people out by IQ and the ability to complete complex tasks. That is why the corporations recruit there. That's why the high-paying firms recruit there. No firm hires from a university thinking, maybe this kid studied postmodernism. Right. Or, oh, look, this guy did sociology of gender. That is not why universities hire. Why businesses hire. If anything, they do it despite that.
So the universities are essentially, whatever other pretensions they might have, they're essentially doing a first cut of the applicant pool for major corporations.
Yes, and I think it's more than a first cut in the sense of if you graduate from a flagship university, you've passed the first cut and been given a major push towards success. And parents do not invest in the quality of a kid's education. They invest, and it's a rational choice, they invest in the value of the degree to their children. What kind of options does it open up?
What is the role of the humanities in higher education? And where does it need to go to regain some sense of legitimacy, recognizing the humanities have been under attack from at least the moment that they became recognized as the humanities? But how do you defend this?
One, I think you have to make a fundamental distinction between the humanities in their current form, as they exist with political litmus tests in hiring and with partisan political agendas often.
In research.
In programs, in research and in teaching and in the nature of courses.
Okay, well, talk a little bit about that because, and you're not saying here that people who study or research or analyze what might be called minor histories or, you know, seemingly irrelevant people. I mean, you're not making a kind of grandiose claim that we should only be studying history and literature and art from above, passing on the received wisdom of our forefathers.
No, far from it. And I have always voted to hire people who think radically different from myself, who are asking questions that I wouldn't ask. The problem is that a lot of those people wish to clone themselves in their department. And see voices that are dissident to their own orthodoxies as uncollegial rather than as an interesting addition or mix in the debate. But let's go back to your main point, not what's happened to certain fields in the humanities, but the value of the humanities in general.
Right.
What I note, and I've been teaching at the University of Pennsylvania since 1968, is students of mine who take demanding courses in the humanities. They master whatever is out there next. All they have to do is get a foot in the door, and their intelligence, their ability to think critically, their ability to analyze other people's perspectives, their ability to read difficult and complex texts, their openness to understanding how different people think, let them write their own ticket. So it's very common for me to have students whose parents, they tell me, are forever saying to them, how could you study intellectual history in college? What is that going to get you? Well, what it gets them is a door inside of what used to be Boston Consulting, where they quickly stand out in terms of their intelligence. Or if they go into the nonprofit world, they quickly stand out.
And that is because, I mean, in a well-executed humanities course of study, you are being more synthetic in terms of pulling different things together. You situate things in particular cultural contexts, historical, economic, literary, whatever.
I mean, the double benefit is you're simultaneously being more synthetic in exactly the way you've described and more analytic. And the ability to combine those, to read things in context, to read things looking for the culture and the society and the meanings out of which they've emerged, this deepens and it sharpens the mind. But if you are taking a course, the goal of which is to make you understand that you have false consciousness, that you don't understand the way in which America has brainwashed and mystified your mind, which has given us, and I believe it's an increasing phenomenon with each passing year, a faculty that thinks of its primary goal as the demystification of students who have been brainwashed and given false consciousness by consumer capitalist America, that is not of intellectual value, though you might still engage some interesting texts in the course of that.
And that also then, I mean, essentially in that sense, while they're demystifying the humanities or power relations, they're also ultimately devaluing what they're studying.
Well, that's exactly right. And they are contributing to the very crisis of the humanities that they are bemoaning. When I was an undergraduate at Princeton,
this would have been in the early 60s.
I was a history major, took a ton of literature courses, some classics courses. What the surveys tell me, and it's obvious in retrospect from personal conversations, almost everyone who taught me was on the left. There was no way to know that from their teaching, from their curriculum. And what inspired me in terms of how I teach, and I think it's a model for both history and the humanities in general. So I was taking a course from a Marxicizing Princeton historian of the 20th century who gave us a great diversity of things to read, but among them some pieces of his own, so students knew where he was coming from. When he gave back the midterms, he said, "You have shamed me. I gave you a lot of different perspectives to read, and you all told me what you thought I wanted to hear. So for the final exam, I am going to assign the book I disagree with most about the 20th century. And I am not going to ask you to critique it. I am going to ask you to recreate its arguments with intellectual empathy so that I know that you are intimately familiar with points of view other than my own." The text was Hayek's The Road to Serfdom. It completely changed my own intellectual and moral life and trajectory. And as it happened, I said to myself, I already knew I wanted to teach. That's how I want to teach. I want my students to understand other perspectives empathetically from within, and then they can make their judgments later on.
What is driving the kind of shift from trying to inculcate critical thinking to a sense of indoctrination. And this, I say this as we've had these conversations in other contexts, but when I went to undergrad and grad school, I started grad school in the late 80s, and by the mid-90s, I was done with it. But I noticed even then a shift from a kind of older model, which I identified with 60s revolts, where you would go to college and you would have teach-ins. You know, there was a lot of politics, but it was all about let's talk about stuff. And even in my PhD courses, there was an older generation of 60 professors who were trained in the 60s who wanted to argue about everything. And then there were people a beat later who were like, no, the arguments are done, and now what we need to do is go out there, and we're doing missionary work. We're not engaging in free play or inquiry.
That's right, and missionary work is the antithesis of a critical education and real dialogue.
So what was going on there? I mean, and as somebody who, if you started in 68, you're of of several generations before current people coming out with PhDs, but what was the shift?
Let's go back to the 70s to set it in context. In 1971, I co-founded at Penn a college house that we recruited students in every imaginable context, and we strove.
Were you able to have, did you have women at Penn by then?
Well, yes, and we were the first college house to be co-ed with men and women living on the same floor. Okay. We insisted on that.
Yeah.
All four classes,
right,
quarter each,
yeah,
half men, half women.
Right.
We very consciously sought what to me is real diversity. We wanted kids from Wharton. We wanted poets. We wanted kids very active politically. We wanted kids who spent their days in laboratories.
Right.
And we ended up for 8 years with the most extraordinary house. We had the first wave of gay liberation activists at Penn. We had the executive board of Campus Crusade for Christ.
Hmm. And I'm guessing they were the same person.
But that's right.
They just didn't know it, yeah.
They didn't know it. We had Maoist revolutionaries. We had the virtually underground college Republicans. We had the first wave of really militant feminists on campus. And we had lots of people from the leadership of the Catholic Newman Center. At a time when Penn was about 3% black, just inviting students to come to a place where you could just be yourself. Mm-hmm. That's the way we presented ourselves. Integrate your intellectual and residential life, cultural and residential life, and just be yourself. Time when Penn was 3% black, we were 20% black, absolutely extraordinary. And these kids argued all the time. They spent their life arguing, but they humanized their relationships. They learned to talk to each other. They identified their points of disagreement. I was there, a Hayekian defender of free market, surrounded by majority of students who thought
As the students were arguing, were your faculty colleagues also arguing?
Yes.
So, and then, I mean, so what happened that we, I mean, the picture you're painting here is, you know, is unimaginable, essentially, on most campuses.
That's correct.
Where you segregate by ideology or, you know, or this type of free space is not being allowed anymore.
I think what happened at Penn is typical of what happened in a lot of places. The ideology that came to dominate all thinking about undergraduate life is people are only really comfortable with people like themselves residentially. So Penn built Du Bois College House for black students. Our students at Van Pelt College House were under fierce pressure to join that. Ironically, Penn then was sued by the NAACP for racial segregation, so they made it if you're interested in black culture. But originally it was for black students. They built an East Asia house. Mm-hmm. They built a pre-med house.
Right.
They built an arts house. Mm-hmm. We used to have people who were doing seminars on artificial intelligence for the love of it, no credit. We had string quartets, we had people who were on the frontiers of endless fields, and now the university sense was, well, if they live with people like themselves, they'll be more comfortable. We had a phenomenally, wonderfully integrated house racially. University decided against precisely what we had demonstrated, that no black students should be encouraged to live with black students. And then the myth went, they would feel so strong that they comfortably would move out into the larger community.
What was the parallel in the intellectual? Because, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that a lot of the discussion about college and university or higher education is always about the student experience. But I actually think the value of college and universities is that they are centers of knowledge production, you know, both in the humanities or the sciences or whatever, and that the real beating heart of a university is its faculty life, not its students' life. Was there that kind of siloing of knowledge and of discussion
at
the faculty level as well?
It was quite extraordinary, not only in terms of the very different four faculty and eight graduate students who were fellows, resident fellows in the house, along with 180 undergraduates with no police role. We weren't sniffing out drugs, which were omnipresent. We were there as intellectual, cultural, human resources. Every faculty member and graduate student there taught a For the Love of It seminar every week, all of which were full. Undergraduates loved having that. And once a week, we invited faculty members to come in and talk about their research, African history, brain structure, evolutionary psychology. It was absolutely extraordinary. And we would get 100, 120 kids out of 180 thrilled that a faculty member was coming down to talk about his or her research. That doesn't happen anymore. And it's very, very sad.
How come? Is it, but what happened?
I think the infantilization of students played a certain role in that. For example, every Wednesday night, our students could invite, we dined together four nights a week as a house. Our students could invite any faculty member they wished to get to know better to come to the house for dinner. A table would be set up for people who wanted to dine. But what made that possible to a certain extent was it was preceded by a wine and sherry hour. Now the university comes in and decides that, that students are children. There can be no drinking between with faculty members and students together. And it used to take about 20 minutes of disinhibition at our sherry hours. It's like a fifth grade dance, boys on one side, girls on the other.
And you know, my fifth grade dances didn't have much sherry, but I get what you said.
You get the scene. And resident faculty used to, in the beginning, would go to faculty and say, look, the students are here because they want to meet you. And same to the students. And after a little disinhibition from wine and sherry, the conversations would become extraordinary. And most faculty were on a first name basis at our college,
which I assume was contrary to the more, I mean, a more conventional approach.
I would walk across campus and people would go, hi, Professor X, hi, Professor Y, hey, Alan, which I liked. And these were students who disagreed with me passionately about politics. So undergraduate culture was overwhelmingly on the left. We loved each other, and we talked and argued.
Now, you would grant,
into the wee
hours. There was, at various points, I'm sure some of that collegiality bled over into exploitation or difficulty in between students and professors.
I mean, I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
Or no more so than is happening now, even stricter
certainly
behavioral.
And if anything, I think people may have even been more careful. It was a goldfish bowl. Students used to joke that the last person you'd have a relationship with would be someone in the house, because everyone would be aware of it.
Now, talk about the...
Go back to that for a second, though. One of the ways in which students have been infantilized is the view that female students lack agency and will be exploited by predatory professors. I met my wife in Vanderbilt College House. So we weren't married till 2 years later.
This is now turning into a To Catch a Predator.
There you go. Exactly. You've got me. So decades later, the School of Arts and Sciences at Penn passed no intimacy between professors and students. Mm-hmm. I believe I was the only faculty member to speak out against it. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, what everyone who knows evolution knows is assortative mating. Mm-hmm. You get two people in a lab interested in the same protein. Mm-hmm. They live in that lab. They talk science together all the time. It's the most natural way for people to meet similar people. Colleges are great centers of assortative mating. Right. Faculty looked at me as if I were out of my mind. It passed. I was invited with my wife to a dinner at the dean's. Yeah. And I introduced my wife to the dean, and I said, Rosemary, if your policy had been in place, this loving marriage wouldn't exist. Our beautiful children wouldn't exist. She turned red and said, I'm not an anti-romantic, but you have got to protect women from predatory professors. And my wife said to her, no, your real problem would have been how to protect professors from predatory young women such as I and my friends who found them of great interest, and these poor innocents didn't know what to do with us.
Well, you know, you've written...
My last invitation to a dean's house,
I was going to say, they brought your car around immediately. You've written in Reason and also in books like The Shadow University about this return of in loco parentis, and it is kind of stunning that the 60s gets all the misty-eyed remembrances, but it was really in the 70s where colleges, undergraduate courses of study were widened, where people could make more choices, students could make more choices, living decisions and things like that. And that, it looked like it was going to be the new normal, but in fact it's been revealed to be a very brief window, because colleges now dictate courses of study much more than they used to.
Absolutely.
How you live, who you live with, how you talk. Where is that coming from?
I think your question is the essential one that has to be asked about what happened to university education. The same generation that gave us the free speech movement gave us speech codes. Mm-hmm. The same generation that gave us mandatory chapel. My freshman year at Princeton was the last year of mandatory chapel, but at least they advertised it.
Right.
Has now given us mandatory sensitivity training and diversity education before you read a single book or participate in a single
religion,
debate.
But it's still there.
Yes. Yeah. And the same kids who got themselves treated as young adults and who smoke pot openly on college lawns everywhere now ban drinking beer in dormitories. It's a generational swindle of epic proportions. And it happened, the first sign of it was cultural, not political. It was the extraordinary antipathy of faculty to disco. Suddenly, students are not listening to the Doors and the Stones and Jeff Beck. They're listening to disco. What the hell is that?
First they came for Lips, Inc. and Funky Town.
There you are.
Okay.
But I think the turning point in which university said, someone's got to save these kids from themselves, was the election of 1984, where a majority of college students voted for Ronald Reagan. And suddenly, the generation that expected to be gurus and leaders and mentors forever, and as long as people followed them, give them absolute freedom. But now, it was perfectly obvious, if these kids had voted for Reagan, that these kids had to be saved from themselves, and the first thing to go was the freedom and the adult status
had gotten. Is also related to Ronald Reagan, because through his Department of Transportation effectively raised the national drinking age in that period, which must have had a huge effect. I mean, you know, now all we talk about on campus is binge drinking and things like that. But I mean, at least from the very early days of the first universities in Europe through the mid-80s, drinking and college were very heavily correlated.
Yes. If you tell most European students and faculty that it would be cause to be fired from an American university if you went drinking with your students, which I do, by the way. I do go drinking with my students. Europeans are absolutely incredulous. Mm-hmm. Not that I want their educational system, but their students are adults in terms of how the university perceives and treats them. Not necessarily students in terms of how the university.
Now, I mean, this ongoing infantilization, this return of In Loco Parentis, was one of the spurs to you creating with Harvey Silverglate FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And talk a little bit about how the activities of that organization respond to kind of incursions, not just on free speech, but on due process for student life.
Yes. In terms of free speech, FIRE has never lost a case where it's challenged a speech code in federal court at a public university.
And you're clear that, I mean, you think speech codes are bad ideas at private universities, but they are governed differently, or they should be governed differently than a public university, where, because it's publicly funded and supported, it has to follow the First Amendment.
Public universities must follow the First Amendment. Right. You can't use a governmental agency to silence people in violation of the First Amendment. What the case is at private universities, FIRE has followed the following principle, that a private university is bound by the promises it makes and the invitation it makes to students to attend there. So if a university says we are a marketplace of ideas, if a university says this is a place where you can say anything, think anything, it's got to hold to that.
Right.
It then can't come in and impose a speech code. If you go to Brigham Young University, you don't awake one morning in your freshman year and say, oh my God, they're Mormon.
Right.
If you choose to go to a Benedictine seminary, it doesn't occur to you, oh, they got me here on the fraudulent terms.
Right.
It's a Catholic seminary.
Right.
That's what it's a voluntary association organized around certain beliefs, and it openly advertises. But most of our universities, private, promise free speech, promise legal equality, and then deliver selective suppression of speech.
And it's based almost always viewpoint specific.
It's always viewpoint specific. So, the easiest way to think of it is the critical word is offend, right? That's what you can't do. You can't offend. The first time that these speech codes were taken literally, and let's say for the sake of argument, some feminist professor were brought up on charges of having verbally harassed evangelical Christian students by her account of the church, the faculty would be out there en masse with free speech, academic freedom banners. But that person's never going to be brought up on charges and knows it. People of certain politics and perspectives are never going to be brought up on charges. So not only are speech codes a violation of that atmosphere of freedom and risk-taking that a university ought to promote, not discourage. Speech codes are also instantaneously and by choice the imposition of double standards and unequal justice.
Now, you know, I think when I talk to people about specific FIRE cases, they're like, oh, that makes sense, you know, that you push back against this. But then there seems to be among people who are not either conservative or libertarian, and conservatives, I think, are often in this because of the viewpoint dimension, not the larger principle mm-hmm. of free expression. But they say, yeah, but you know what? Come on, it comes down to we're talking about frat kids who are doing, slave auctions or saying the word nigger or putting on blackface. What are the typical cases where somebody is having a speech code used against
them? Those cases actually are relatively rare. Mm-hmm. But let's take them. Do you think that a performance of the Vagina Monologues, for example, would be interrupted as sexual harassment and the play banned? Mm-hmm. If a group of feminists put on any college campus, mm-hmm. something that you or I might consider right. male yeah. bashing,
right.
In a nanosecond, right. we would know, no, that's protected speech. So you get selective enforcement. The other thing, of course, is the best answer to speech you don't like is more speech.
Right.
And protest. When I was involved in bringing down the speech code at the University of Pennsylvania, but it was still operative, the university came and honored Andres Serrano's Piss Christ. Mm-hmm. It's a crucifix immersed in the artist's urine, and gave him an occasion for an honorary speech, exhibit of Piss Christ, lovingly
done. And this was a work of art that had ties to public funding and was...
In addition to everything yes. else, it was publicly funded.
Right.
Yes,
and was it became a flashpoint in the culture
that's
wars.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
a flashpoint in the culture war of the 80s and 90s.
Exactly yeah. so. So a group of people from the Newman Center and from evangelical groups came to me and said, this is a terrible double standard. Mm-hmm. They should suppress this Andres right. Serrano event. They wouldn't let anyone else be insulted like this except Christians. And I said, why in the world would you want censorship? Right. If I were you, what I would do is hold an event. Mm-hmm. Here's what the cross means to the university. Here's what it means to us. Well, it turned out to be the largest and most significant religious gathering in the history of the University of Pennsylvania. It reminded me of when the American Nazi Party wanted to march in Skokie, which has the very high percentage of Holocaust survivors at the time. And the city fathers banned them. ACLU took the city fathers to court. And the court obviously found city fathers can't ban groups they don't like from peacefully marching. So what happened? The picture that went forth to the world was as the American Nazi Party in their absurd uniforms marching down the street, you see everyone along the sidewalk with their backs turned in contempt. I mean, freedom's a wonderful yeah. medium.
Right.
And if you don't ban speech and expression, you have to deal with it. And if you can't do that at a university, where on earth can you do it? How astonishing that you have greater freedom to publish what you want in the language in which you want to publish it out there in civil society than you would were you a campus magazine. And I guarantee you that Reason published on a campus would be defunded and that you'd be up on harassment charges every other week.
Is it that we don't need as much free speech? And I'm not saying this is a good thing, but we don't need as much free speech on campuses because it's busting out all over the place, despite all attempts to quash it, whether through political speech codes or campaign finance or whatever.
But it isn't.
Whatever.
It isn't. In terms of college campuses, I teach an honor seminar on the history of classical liberal thought. John Stuart Mill, Spencer, Bastiat, Hayek, Mises, etc. And students uniformly, without exception, tell me afterwards they have no idea of my own beliefs. Mm-hmm. It's analytic and comparative. Mm-hmm. Students tell me it is the first time they have ever read, and in many cases, heard of Peter Bauer, even if they're students at Wharton.
Yeah.
They've never heard of Hayek. They've never heard of Milton Friedman. So it's not clear that debate is busting out all over.
Well, thank you, Alan Kors, for talking with Reason TV. This has been great. For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.